I want to begin first by thanking Steve Moore, one of our debaters, for consenting on such short notice to participate in this debate. As some of you may know, it was originally going to be about RFK Jr.'s candidacy. We realized that wouldn't be much of a debate, but we spoke, at this point, we're not much of a debate, so we spoke to David Stockman, and we picked up some of his fiery prose and asked him if he would defend the following resolution, which I'm going to read to you again. In the current presidential election, both Democrats and Republicans consist of a uniparty that would lead us to the bottom of the national policy dumpster. Now, those of you who read David Stockman know that, of course, that word dumpster is the kind of word he likes to use because he likes to write in very engaging, fiery prose, which I'm sure you're going to enjoy hearing this evening as well. But we were told by Steve that he does have to leave at a relatively early hour this evening if he were to participate in the debate. We're so happy to have him take the negative against David that we consented to that. So without any further preliminaries, I want first of all, again, for you to decide right now to vote yes, no, or undecided on the resolution. I'll give you about 10 seconds to do that. Please vote yes, no, or undecided on the resolution about Democrats and Republicans leading us to the bottom of the national policy dumpster. Now that you voted, I'm going to ask that David Stockman, defending the resolution, come to the stage. David? Opposing the revolution, Steve Moore. Steve, please come to the stage. Jane, please close the voting. David, you have 17 and a half minutes to make your case at the podium if you'd like. Take it away, David.
Well, good evening, and I'm obliged to start by thanking Gene for a very tough opponent, but also assigning me the very easy side of the debate question before us. The fact is, the bottom of the national policy dumpster, as I call it, is already in plain sight, and the two uniparty candidates will surely complete the remaining descent with equal alacrity. Lower it? Okay. Now you got it? All right. That's because neither Trump nor Harris will do a damn thing about the three overwhelming threats to capitalist prosperity and constitutional liberty in America. Number one, the exploding public debt. Number two, our rogue central bank that both enables the Washington spenders and fattens the brokerage accounts of the top 1% while punishing the fast-shrinking middle class with persistent inflation. And number three, Washington's failing global empire that is bleeding the US Treasury dry, even as it pushes the world to the brink of nuclear war. So let's start with the skyrocketing public debt. Now, it was $1 trillion when I became budget director, and that wasn't exactly ancient history, because as you can see, I'm still here. And quite vertical, as a matter of fact. Debt was then $20 trillion when Trump arrived at the Oval Office, who wasted no time adding another $8 trillion or more in 4 years than the first 43 presidents racked up during the first 216 years of the Republic. Next, it will be $36 trillion when Sleepy Joe finishes his own $8 trillion add-on, proving that his is as big as the Donald's when it comes to the fiscal violation of the nation's taxpayers. And from there, it's off to the races. Baked-in uniparty tax and spending policies will add still another $25 trillion over the next decade. But rather than attacking Washington's doomsday borrowing machine, the Donald wants to layer on $8 trillion more of debt to increase the hideously bloated defense budget by 25%, allegedly to make up for inflation, give free IVF treatments to all Americans, including, apparently, the childless cat ladies, extend the unpaid-for 2017 tax cuts at a cost of $5 trillion over a decade, and exempt tips and Social Security and overtime from taxes entirely, and corporate income mostly, or at least down to 15%. Now, don't get me wrong, I am all for minimizing taxes, but you've got to earn the right to reduce taxes by cutting spending by an amount equal to at least 85% of the revenue loss. That's because under today's lowish marginal rates, fully 96% of tax filers, accounting for 75% of the $10 trillion in annual taxable compensation, are in the bottom four brackets, between 10 and 24%. Now, down there, a couple of points of marginal rates, either up or down, has no meaningful impact on work, output, investment, and income. So even according to the very conservative Tax Foundation, you only get a 15% revenue flowback from each dollar of the Trump tax cuts. Indeed, on the $1.8 trillion cost of exempting Social Security from federal income taxes completely, there would be no reflow at all. These folks are already non-working retirees and are unlikely to take leave of their golf courses in Florida or their nursing homes up north, as the case may be, to take a greeter's job at Walmart's. Kamala's just as bad, of course, with at least $3 trillion of new free stuff. That includes a $25,000 door prize for each and every one of the nation's 1.7 million first-time homebuyers each year, and also bigger subsidies for Obamacare and the EITC and child credits, and $6,000 to buy bassinets, bottles, and bonnets for each of America's 3.6 million newborn babies annually. So the Uniparty now has now locked in place, plus all the new free stuff being peddled by Trump and Harris. It will take the public debt to $65 trillion in the early 2030s, and according to CBO's latest rosy scenario forecast, it will reach 166% of GDP by mid-century. Of course, by 2050, the debt will actually be a lot bigger than 166% of GDP, because CBO's rosy scenario assumes there won't be a recession or any other economic emergency, inflation flare-up, or interest rate surge during the entirety of the next 25 years. And if you believe that, I know a broker of Florida swampland that I can put you in touch with right away. Still, the reason CBO's 2050 debt figure is expressed as a kind of antiseptic percentage of GDP rather than the whole number is that even the ultra-optimistic projection would literally terrify the voters. What no one in Washington will say out loud is that in round greenback dollars and cents, the CBO says the public debt will hit $150 trillion by mid-century. Perhaps that number sounds a tad large, and it should, because it amounts to 1.5 times the current GDP of the entire planet. Yet that's the inexorable and minimum possible result of the Uniparty's pact with the fiscal devil, which both the Donald and the Cackler have signed on to lock, stock, and barrel. Of course, the correct way to tackle the impending tsunami of red ink is by shrinking the $85 billion spending baseline, especially when you only have $55 trillion of baseline revenue under current law and the Donald's great big free lunch tax cuts. But not by the lights of the Uniparty consensus with respect to the four dominant components amounting to 91% of the budget. Of these, both Trump and Harris say no cuts, as in nothing, nix, nada, nugatory, and yet. The first component is what we call the big welfare state of Social Security and Medicare, which alone will cost $36 trillion in the next decade, or 42% of the total spending. Yet the Trumpified GOP wing of the Uniparty says it won't touch a dime of Social Security or Medicare, despite the fact that average workers get back 2 to 3 times more in benefits than the present value of the taxes they paid in. The second spending basket is the little welfare state of Medicaid, Obamacare, food stamps, and other means-tested benefits, which will cost $13 trillion over the next decade. But in constant 2024 dollars, those programs had already reached $940 billion per year in December 2016, when Obama skedaddled the White House for a more commodious dwelling on Martha's Vineyard. And it was up by 8% more in constant dollars when the Donald shuffled off to Mar-a-Lago, clutching a file of New York Times clippings that some deep state operative had classified as top secret. And in the not a dime's worth of difference modality, we will have grown by roughly the same amount, 10% in constant dollars, when next January they usher out Sleepy Joe in a wheelchair or on a gurney, as the case may be. So the Donald couldn't even best the Biden-Harris crew when it comes to curtailing free stuff to poor people. Thirdly, we have the baseline warfare state budget, including defense, foreign ops, and veterans, which will cost $15 trillion over the decade. But the Donald wants 25% more, and Kamala brags about all the lethal weapons she intends to deploy against any and all nations who give any gaff to the neocons who might be placed in her cabinet by her new best friend, Dick Cheney. Finally, there is another $13 trillion owing to net interest on the public debt. And the latter assumes that notwithstanding this torrent of spending and borrowing, the weighted average yield on the federal debt will be just 3% over the next decade, and there's a fat chance of that. As it happens, therefore, these four buckets add up to $77 trillion under uniparty policy in the next decade, or the aforementioned 91% of CBO's baseline spending. But if the uniparty candidates stand for zero savings, don't be fooled by Trump's promise to put Elon Musk in charge of a waste and fraud commission. Now, Musk is surely a brilliant businessman, but that is no qualification whatsoever for staunching Washington's torrents of red ink. That's because the federal government is not a business in any way, shape, or form, and fraud, waste, and abuse have virtually nothing to do with the sorry national debt. To the contrary, as we have seen, Washington operates a giant free stuff club that includes the households of more than 150 million Americans. But in the immortal words of comedian George Carlin, the fact that you are here tonight means you ain't in it, as he said it. In any event, when you set aside war, welfare, and mandatory interest expense from the $85 trillion of baseline spending over the next decade, you have only $8 trillion left for the entirety of domestic programs and bureaucracies. This includes the National Park Service, NIH Health Research, the Air Traffic Control System, farm subsidies, highways, the FBI, the DEA, the DOJ, the Patent Office, NASA, and the entirety of the Departments of Education, Interior, Labor, Energy, and much more like and similar expense. So even if the Donald's Musk Commission comes up with 25% efficiency savings in all these departments and activities, it would lower the public debt from $65 trillion to, well, $63 trillion by 2034. A big deal, it's actually not. On the other hand, Musk doesn't have a snowball's chance in the hot place of penetrating the military-industrial congressional complex. And the problem with entitlements is not fraud, but the fact that trillions of benefits provided by statute cannot be stopped unless Congress changes the laws. For instance, Social Security alone will cost $20 trillion over the next decade, but the administrative overhead is less than a penny per dollar. And the only serious fraudulent enrollments that have ever been ballyhooed is that dead people are allegedly not kicked off the rolls fast enough. In fact, President Reagan kept telling me that this was surely a gusher of waste, but it never checked out because the rolls are actually pruned quite quickly upon the filing of death certificates, including recoupment of payments made during the month of the of death from the decedent's family. For crying out loud, they don't even prorate for the days people were still above ground, just in case your loved ones don't already know about that. As it happens, about 2.7 million Social Security recipients depart for the great beyond annually, and their average benefit is about $1,700 a month. So catching them within 5 days after the body has gone cold would save about $3.8 billion per year, or 0.2% of current Social Security outlays. With respect to the warfare state, even Elon Musk wouldn't find much to reduce from the $15 trillion for national security. That's because it's driven by hegemonic missions around the globe, not simply weapon systems that are too expensive in what amounts to a bespoke market controlled by military contractors and the legislators they bankroll. In short, to save anything material from the $15 trillion warfare state baseline, you have to bring the empire home. That means canceling current missions such as protecting the sandbars in the South China Sea or the shipping lanes in the Red Sea and the Black Sea and the Baltic Sea and a lot of other seas. And it also means revoking the right of small-time politicians like Marcos Jr. in the Philippines and the Russia bashers in the Baltics to poke their neighbors in the eye behind the shield of Washington's security guarantees, all of which are now Cold War relics having nothing to do with legitimate homeland security. Finally, the Federal Reserve is completely in the tank for the Uniparty. It has been the great enabler of the soaring public debt because it has monetized trillions of treasury paper, even as its ridiculously low interest rates have fueled immense financial bubbles. Harris, in particular, keeps yammering about her abiding commitment to the regular working folks of America, but has never once mentioned the depredations of the nation's rogue central bank. That is to say, the bicoastal billionaires are laughing all the way to the Democrat Uber Donors Club, even as the pinch-hitting marionette they have stood up to replace Joe Biden probably couldn't find the Eccles building in a self-driving car. The fact is, the Uniparty has more or less been in power since 1988, when the Gipper rode off into the sunset with his work still far from done, and upon perhaps inadvertently saddling the nation with the horror of Alan Greenspan at the Fed, where its balance sheet has exploded from $300 billion to $7.5 trillion. That 25 times gain amounts to five orders of magnitude more than the growth of national income in the same period. And yet, Donald Trump spent his entire term in the Oval Office castigating the Fed for not printing even more fiat credits, and once went so far as to demand zero interest rates so that the U.S. would have even lower rates than imposed by the wackadoos at the Central Bank of Japan. At the end of the day, the number one, the number two, and the number three priority in America is bringing the utterly out-of-control money-printing machine at the Fed to heel. But the GOP, the once and former party of sound money and the gold standard, has been taken over by a monetary policy ignoramus. Based on his utterances, the Donald would give Congressman Wright Patman, Senator Huey Long, and William Jennings Bryan himself a run for the title of economic crackpot of the century. So the bottom line is simple. We are heading to the bottom of the policy dumpster no matter which of the Uniparty candidates wins. The silver lining, however, is that both the Donald and the Cackler have a good chance of producing 4 years of such unrelenting disaster for the American people as to finally cause them to abandon both wings of the Uniparty. And fortunately, there is now waiting to emerge from the ashes a new Reclaim America Party, led by Bobby Kennedy, Tulsi Gabbard, Elon Musk, Tucker Carlson, J.D. Vance, Nicole Shanahan, Vivek Ramaswamy, Rand Paul, and hopefully many of you. It may well be, in fact, that in the midst of this very dark election, the warmongers, the spenders, and the statists will finally be given their walking papers, and none too soon. Thank you.
Thank you. Steve Moore, 17 and a half minutes to make the case against. Take it away, Steve.
Honor to be here. Thank you so much for inviting me. I think maybe I'll start by quoting the president that you and I both work for and just say, well, David, there you go again. I'm a great admirer of David Stockman, and I was telling David that I think his book, The Triumph of Politics, is one of the most important political science books of all time. And everyone should, even, let's say you wrote that, what, 39 years ago or something like that? It's hard to believe. It really does summarize the dysfunction in Washington that David talked about. And look, I agree with probably, 70% of what David just said. So I don't think there's a huge difference in our view of the world. But I'm here to defend Donald Trump. I served as Trump economic advisor in 2016. Oh, and by the way, one of your great accomplishments among many, David, was hiring my buddy and the best man in my wedding, Larry Kudlow, as your chief economist. So I want to kind of talk about what Trump did in his first term, why he did it, why I think it matters a lot. I'll start by saying that I couldn't agree more that I think that this $35 trillion debt is a cancer cell in the American economy. And I can't say whether it's going to be 3 weeks from now or 3 months from year now or 3 years from now, but if we stay on the current course, David Stockman is right. We will have a financial crisis that will be extraordinarily painful. So we have to do something about this debt before we get, you want to steer the Titanic away from the iceberg before it hits it. And that's why, what you've been saying about the debt is so important. But it's also true that, my kind of joke about David Stockman is he has predicted 8 of the last 3 recessions. So you've been Mr. Doom and Gloom for a long time. And I want to say something about the Reagan years, because I think this is really important. It's really formulated my thoughts about the economy. I think you underappreciate what we accomplished and what you accomplished in the 1980s. I lived through the 1970s. I remember, the 12% inflation and the 17% mortgage interest rates, and our American economy was in the trash can. And Reagan saved the economy. He saved the American economy. And he also won the Cold War without firing a shot, which is pretty cool when you think about it. And the reason I mention that is because one thing that frustrates me about David Stockman is I feel like you don't appreciate actually what you accomplished. The fact is that when Reagan came into office, the highest income tax rate in the United States was 70%. The highest corporate tax rate was 50%. We were not competitive. And Reagan, thanks to people like Art Laffer, realized that there is a Laffer curve effect. And the Laffer curve is very simple. It simply says if you tax something, you get less of it, right? We all know that. If you tax something, you get less of it. And if you tax something less, you get more of it. Now, we could argue about whether you're going to raise more revenue from a tax cut and so on. Maybe you will, maybe you won't. But the fact is that our tax rates were way, way too high. And there was no way we could prosper as a nation with those rates. And one of the greatest accomplishments of my lifetime in policy was that when Reagan entered office, our highest tax rate was 70%. And when Reagan left office, the highest tax rate in the United States was 28%. That's an amazing achievement when you think about it. And the incentives for investment, for saving, for growth, for work were dramatically improved. Instead of being able to keep 30 cents on the dollar at a 70% tax rate, you were able to keep 72 cents on the dollar. So the incentive to invest and to save and to create a business was doubled. And so it's no surprise that we saw the boom in the American economy. And one of the things that I disagree with David about is, yes, the debt is a staggering number, and it is very, very frightening to all of us. However, it's important to realize that borrowing in and of itself, and I'd love to hear David's response to this, borrowing in and of itself is not a bad thing. It really depends on what you're borrowing for. And I would make the case that, and by the way, it is, isn't it ironic, David, that we were sweating over $100 billion deficits, you know, 40 years ago, and here we are today with a $2 trillion deficit. So it is sickening what's going on in Washington today. We're on an order of magnitude higher deficits today than back when David Stockman was OMB director. But we did. What did we borrow for in the 1980s? We borrowed to fund that tax cut to rebuild the American economy. And we borrowed to have the, one of the biggest buildups in our military, I guess since the World War II. And we, what's the old saying, that Reagan won the Cold War without firing a shot. And one of the things to think about is what is the, when you think about all that money that we spent, and maybe we, and I agree with David, we probably wasted a lot of money on the Pentagon, and you talk a lot about that in your book. But the truth is that what is the discounted present value to society, to young people, I see some young people in this room, to not having an evil empire, to not having the Soviet Union? I would say the benefit to that is in the tens and tens of trillions of dollars. I mean, remember in the late 1970s and early 1980s, one of the greatest, if you asked Americans, what are you most worried about? Obviously, it was inflation and low growth. But the single biggest worry of Americans at that time was global thermonuclear war, because of the tension between these crazy people in the Kremlin and the United States. And so by winning the Cold War, that was a gigantic, gigantic achievement for our country that we will, for decades and decades and decades, continue to feel the dividends of. And the other thing, we built the economy. And so I think those were good investments, and I think they were worth borrowing for. The other thing to think about is the period 1980 to about 2005, that's about a 25-year period, was the greatest period of wealth creation in the history of civilization. No country has seen anything like what's happened in the United States. One of my favorite statistics is that when, you may remember this, David, in the summer of 1982, the Dow Jones Industrial Average hit 800. 800. Think about that. What is the Dow Jones Industrial Average today? 40,000. So think about the debt is a big problem, but the wealth of the American people has increased by the tens and tens of trillions of dollars. Now, I'm not saying we can afford this debt. I'm just saying you have to look at the debt relative to our incomes and ability to repay it. And when you look at it from that standpoint, it's not quite as daunting. It is daunting, and David's right about that, but it's not quite as daunting. One of my fundamental things that I always have told Donald Trump and members of Congress and senators and governors is, I'd love to hear, again, David's response on this. Growth is everything. And I know David's going to flinch when I say this, but we can grow our way out of this deficit and the debt. We can grow our way out of this debt. If you look at those charts, those numbers that you were reciting, David, and those are accurate, if you look at the forecast by the Congressional Budget Office, which is what those numbers are based on, they are forecasting 1.7% growth for the American economy over the next 10, 20, 30, 40 years. And to that I say, hell no, we're America. We're not going to grow at 1.7%. We're going to do everything possible in a second Trump term to grow the economy at almost double that pace. I think we can get the growth rate up to 3.25%. That's been the path of the American economy since post-World War II, set our aspirations high. Now, we could have an argument about whether that's achievable or not, and that's a good argument to have, but it's a good aspiration. And I'm going to tell you this. First of all, without more economic growth, David, it doesn't matter how much you raise taxes, how much we cut spending, you're not going to make much progress on the debt. You've got to get the economy growing, because that's what generates the revenues in the economy. And the second point I would make related to this, that if we were to get to, if you look at the curve on the debt, and I think we'd agree that you want to look at the debt as a share of our GDP. Is that a fair, assessment? So David's right. I mean, those numbers are just frightening. They just go straight up like a rocket ship. But if you put 3 to 3.25% growth in that, guess what? It starts to bend down. And it down. So growth, I think, is critical, and that's something I've told Trump. Now, I think I've got, how much more time have I got left? About 5 minutes or so. Okay. So let me just spend my remaining time talking about the Trump tax cut, because I take this personally, because I, you know, with Larry Kudlow and with Kevin Hassett and a couple of others, we kind of designed the first idea of the Trump tax cut. And I'll just walk you through some of the kind of gems of that tax bill, because I'm proud of it. And I think one of the things that I disagree with David about is, you know, you said, well, it's going to cost X, I don't even remember the number, over the next 10 years. Wait a minute. The people, if you look at what the projection was for federal tax revenues before we passed the Trump tax bill. In other words, here's what CBO said would be tax revenues without the Trump tax cut. And then you look at what happened with the Trump tax cut, we're actually higher. Our revenues are higher today than they were without the Trump tax cut. In other words, you could make a strong case that those tax cuts did pay for themselves. Now, what did we do? What were the fundamental elements of that tax cut? First and foremost, the crown jewel of that tax cut was reducing the federal corporate tax rate, the tax rate that we impose on American businesses. And I remember showing Trump a chart of, you know, we're up here, the rest of the world's down here, and Trump said it very well. He said, this is like putting a tariff on our own goods and services. What country does that? You know, it's economic masochism. We're up here and the rest of the world's down here. That doesn't work, right? It just doesn't work. We're putting the United States, our average rate was 40%, theirs was 20%. And all the other countries in the world were down, 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 down. They kept cutting their tax rates. Why? Why were they doing that? The reason they were doing that was they were trying to steal jobs and businesses and manufacturing from the United States. They're trying to rob us. By the way, the country that has the highest growth rate in all of Europe today is Ireland. Ireland has the lowest corporate tax rate at 12.5%, and they're just soaking in capital. So tax rates really do have a big impact on where money is invested. So we cut that rate from 40% to down to about 25%, and that had a huge impact. We brought in about $1 trillion of capital as a result of that tax bill. Second of all, we doubled the standard deduction. Now, that's a big loss to revenue when you double the standard deduction, but I'm a big believer in the flat tax. In fact, you talk about the flat tax, I think, in your book about how George Shultz had this idea of, I like the idea of get rid of all the deductions, lower the rates. Well, we did some of that, but one of the things we did by simplifying the tax system is by doubling the standard deduction. Prior to that, about 35 to 40% of Americans had to itemize their deductions. They had to keep the shoeboxes full of all the receipts and blah, 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 and it was a complicated thing for people. Now, you just check the box and you're done. That was probably the single biggest simplification of our tax system ever to do that. Do we really want to go back to people having to itemize all these stupid deductions? By the way, there's only 9% of Americans today, David, you may know this, only 9% of Americans itemize their deductions. You know who they are? Really, really, really rich people. So, maybe you and I could agree, why don't we just get rid of all the deductions at this point? You want to make the tax code simple? You want to soak the rich? Let's get rid of every single remaining deduction. The homeowner, right? Let's just get rid of it. So the next thing we did, which was huge in terms of making the tax code, quote, fairer, and you all, I know I'm talking to a New York audience, so you're not going to want to hear this, but this is something that, you know, I really pressed. Let's get rid of the state and local tax deduction. Because it's unfair. Why should people in Florida and Texas, Tennessee, pay more taxes for, people who live in New York and my home state of Illinois and California? So the more you, by doing that, it just shifted the tax burden away from the blue states. And by the way, that was all millionaires and billionaires that were taking the big deductions from that. So that was huge. By the way, Trump should have said this in the debate. Kamala Harris is proposing, by getting rid of the Trump tax cut, the biggest tax cut in the history of the United States for millionaires and billionaires by bringing back the state and local tax deduction. The other thing we did was we got rid of the evil alternative minimum tax. Remember that? That was something that prior to that tax cut, 8 million people were ensnared in the alternative minimum tax. We lowered that number from probably, by the way, most of you probably never even heard of the alternative minimum tax in the last 4 years. You know why? Because only 400,000 people today have to pay the alternative minimum tax. And for those of you who don't know what it is, you'd have to fill out one massive tax form, and then you'd have to fill out another one, and you'd have to pay the liability, which was ever was the greater. So we're going to have to bring that back if we get rid of the Trump tax cut. And the other thing we did, and look, you know, I'm a big believer that death should not be a taxable event, and we did reduce the number of people who had to pay the Am I done?
No.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. We cut by about 2/3 the number of people who had to pay the death tax. So on balance, I think it was a positive thing. I'm all in favor of this idea of a commission. I like that idea. I think we could. Look, I think we could cut $1 trillion of this budget. David and I could sit down in a half an hour, and we could cut $1 trillion, and people wouldn't even miss it. This is the abuse that's taken place in Washington, the fraud. I mean, hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars of money was stolen in COVID money. The Biden administration has put a $300 billion green energy slush fund. I think Kamala said she spent, we invested $1 trillion in green energy. What did you get for it? Prior to them coming into office, we got 83% of our energy from fossil fuels. Today, we get 83% of our energy from fossil fuels. There is no green energy transition. It just isn't happening. And so I think we can find the ways to cut waste, grow the economy, and get on a more sane fiscal path. And I'll stop there. Thank you.
Thank you, Steve. David, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal. You want to take the podium? Yeah.
Well, Steve, I think you're right on one thing. As a young man, I went to Washington, and a wise old hand told me on my gloom and doom stuff, if you predict something often enough, sooner or later you'll be right, just like a stopped clock. You know, there are a lot of big issues here that you can look at from many different angles, and I think it's important to get these out. Now, one, there was this huge defense buildup, which undermined what Reagan was really trying to do, which was to shrink the welfare state and shrink the size of government and its intrusion. Well, it undermined it. I'm going to get to that. Yeah, it undermined it because I was there on the firing line, and I have all the cleat marks on my back still after all these years. And the answer was once we got into it, the defense buildup was so huge, $140 billion a year when Carter left, $350 billion a year by 1985. It was so massive, and there was so much waste in the buildup that all of these soldiers that we had on the Republican side on Capitol Hill said, we just can't keep walking the plank on food stamps and, you know, child care subsidies and farm subsidies and all the rest. So they finally gave up because the defense buildup was too big, number one. Number two, I think at the end of the day, Reagan didn't win the Cold War. Communism lost the Cold War. In other words, the Soviet Union was falling apart, unraveling at the seams as we got into the 1980s. The defense buildup that we had may have encouraged the process, but ultimately it wasn't the huge defense buildup. It was the fact, and we never remember this, communism doesn't work. It failed there. It will fail in what I call red capitalism in China today, and we should stop beating the tom-toms and spending all this money on defense that we don't have because we think the Chinese are coming across the Pacific in 100 aircraft carriers that they don't have to invade California, which won't happen. So that's the point I would make. And what happened, and it's a real tragedy and irony, is that big defense buildup, and I fought it tooth and nail all the way, and I had my battles with Cap Weinberger and so forth, and I can even remember one Saturday morning sitting in front of Reagan in the Oval Office, just the two of us, and I said my piece, and he said his piece, and Reagan said, boy, you're both pretty persuasive, but I'm going to have to go with the military, okay? But the point is, in all of that buildup, it wasn't about the threat, the Soviet first strike nuclear threat that was being ballyhooed at the time. Because in the end, that wasn't even true. It was never there. But overwhelmingly, 90% of all that money went to rebuilding conventional forces. the 600-ship Navy, a whole new suite of aircraft and attack helicopters, and, you know, on and on and on, none of which was necessary to defend the United States on the far side of the Pacific Atlantic moats in this day and age with an adequate nuclear deterrent that doesn't cost anything. So it went into a capacity to launch forever wars that we've been doing for the last 30 years that has cost us trillions and trillions and trillions for no good purpose whatsoever. That's the first point. Another point is that, yes, the tax cuts may have helped a little bit, but Volcker really was the one who put the inflation genie back in the bottle because he was tough as nails. In fact, most of the Republican pals at the time wanted to run him out of town, and to his credit, Reagan defended him, but it was the Fed that finally put to bed the massive inflation of the 80s that it created. Now, people will find it a little striking, but the growth rate during Reagan, economic growth from 8 years was 3.4%. Under Carter, it was 3.4%. Under Clinton, it was 3.8%. Under all the presidents from 54 to 2016, it was 3.2%. So the point was, yes, we needed to make big changes, but it didn't end up creating a one-time anomalous, you know, outbreak of growth, and it created the groundwork for the idea, and this is my last point, that Republicans who had been for decades the party of fiscal sobriety ended up believing with Dick Cheney and a whole bunch of others that deficits don't matter or the Fed would take care of the problem by monetizing all of this massive emission of paper. That's what happened, and it was really a bad thing because now we're stuck with a uniparty that wants to spend on defense like no tomorrow, won't take on the welfare state because they've lost their, they've lost their appetite, and as a result of that, we're in a much bigger pickle than a lot of people realize.
Okay, Steve, 5 minutes. Steve, you get an extra 17 seconds above those 5 minutes because he took 17 seconds extra.
I actually don't disagree with a lot of what you just said. I think you're, I guess I would simply say it's probably better to spend a little too much on the military rather than a little too little. And so did we overspend? Yes. And in fact, and I learned so much from your book. The spending that Cass Weinsberger did, as you point out in your book, was way higher than we needed because the inflation rate came down so much. So, you know, we were predicting, 8% inflation, and it came down to 4. I mean, you're right. I mean, and that, look, I think one of the mistakes we made in recent years, let's bring this up to the current situation. I think it was both. I think it was Volcker and Reagan who helped conquer inflation. And look, the reason we call it supply-side economics is because we want to increase the supply of goods and services. And what, you know, as Art Laffer would hear, I wish Arthur was here because, you know, he explains this better than I do. But, you know, if the economy produces more apples, what happens to the price of apples? They go down. They go down. So, yes, you're right. Volcker helped break the back of inflation. And for that, he's godly to me. But also it was the supplies. There was a supply side effect. We got more output when we cut those rates. So let's just talk for a minute about kind of our current situation. And by the way, look, let's not forget that we did balance the budget once in the last 40 years, and that was under Bill Clinton. And I think Bill Clinton is actually one of our underrated presidents of all time. And how did we do it? I mean, they did raise tax rates, and I was opposed to that. But we had a lot of budget discipline. We cut spending. We had the big peace dividend after we won the Cold War. And we had a lot of growth. And the revenues just took off. And that kind of is why I'm so hyper-obsessed with getting that economic growth rate up, because you get that growth rate up, you're going to get revenues. That's the best way to raise revenues, is not to raise the rates, but to get the economy moving. The other quick point I'll make, and then we can get to the discussion, is that there was something called, one of the other really positive things that we did, and this was back, I'm trying to remember, was it maybe 6 or 7 years ago, I'm losing track of time, maybe 8 or 10 years ago, I'm getting old, we did something called the Budget and Control Act. And that bill created spending caps. spending caps on both. And the idea was, if they're over the caps, you have to cut a dollar from the defense budget and a dollar from the domestic budget. And I'm in favor of that. I agree with you. I think there's so much waste in the Pentagon budget. There's no doubt about it. The Pentagon is just a big swamp. And we could easily, I'm for a strong national defense, but I agree with David Stockman. There are ways we could have a much smarter national defense at a much lower cost. So we can do this. We can do it in a way that, but I guarantee you, if Kamala Harris is in and she does what she wants to do, which is the $4.6 trillion tax increase, it is going to capsize our economy. It's going to destroy the stock market. You double the capital gains tax, double the dividend tax, tax unrealized capital gains, increase the corporate tax rate. You're talking about a situation where someone who invests, let's say $1 million into a small business startup, and by the way, 2 out of 3 small businesses fail, so that's a risky proposition to put money in a small business. If they succeed, if that business succeeds, it's going to have to be they have to pay the 35% corporate tax, then they have to pay the higher tax on capital gains, and then blah, blah, blah. So the government's going to take away 70% of your winnings under that plan. You're not going to get any investment under that system. So I guess I think I'll stop there. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, guys. We now go to the lineup in front of that mic to ask your questions. And please phrase it as a question and maybe get these guys off Reagan and a little bit more on Kamala and Don with your questions.
Okay.
Yeah. So take it away, your question.
First of all, I just want to thank both of you gentlemen for your leadership and
what's your question?
Administrations. trying to wrestle with the uniparty concept, you know, there's clearly a lot of differences between the parties, but the two areas where they do seem like uniparties, which you guys didn't even talk about at all, is trade policy with the new tariffs on everything, and sort of this, there's a lot of, the foreign policy, the weakness that Trump has showed on Ukraine. I don't think that you may argue about this, but I think that Biden has been pretty weak on Ukraine, too. It could have been a lot stronger. Maybe you could address the tariff issue. Smoot-Hawley tariffs, are largely credited with triggering the Great Depression. So why aren't you more concerned about the tariff problem?
Could you answer that, Steve, and then David? Please, go ahead. Yes.
Tariffs. You hear me with this? Okay.
Trump's tariffs.
I'll just give you kind of a quick overview of, I think, what Trump's trade strategy is. And I do want to hear David's kind of response to this. So, before I met Trump in 2016, I was a kind of Milton Friedman unilateral free trader. I believe we should just have as low as tariffs as possible. And if the other countries don't want to buy our goods, but they want to give us stuff for free, essentially like China was doing, we ought to do that. And I think Trump has changed my opinion a little bit on tariffs. And I think what Trump has done, look, if you want to understand Donald Trump's overall philosophy, and he's a businessman, and I think, by the way, that alone is a reason to vote for him over Kamala Harris. She knows nothing about business. She knows nothing about the economy. But Trump wrote a very famous book, and what was the name of that book? The Art of the Deal. And Trump understands a very important concept in all negotiations, leverage. Leverage. And what Trump understood is that the United States has leverage over every other country. The global economy is very easy to understand. We're the alpha male, we're the center of the world, and every other country is a spoke. Just like the dollar is the only currency that really matters in the world. And so Trump realized that every country in the world, especially China and our adversary, like China couldn't possibly even succeed as a nation if they weren't able to trade with the United States. And what he did very effectively was he used tariffs as a weapon, as a negotiating tool. And I saw firsthand in a lot, and by the way, that's a risky strategy because it does risk a trade, a tit-for-tat trade war, which none of us want to see. But I saw at least on 3 or 4 occasions where Trump would say in these negotiations, I'll give you one example, just one that pops to mind. I remember we were negotiating with Mexico, on something. I don't even remember what it was. And Trump said to the Mexican delegation, you're going to have to help us get secure the border. You're going to have to help us do that. And the Mexicans said, go to hell. We're not going to. It's your responsibility to enforce the border, not ours. And so Trump said, okay, if you're not going to help us enforce the border, we're going to place a 30% tariff on everything that comes in from Mexico. And guess what? 2 days later, they said, okay, we'll help with the border. We saw that with NATO. I mean, Trump basically said to the NATO countries, if you don't start paying your dues for NATO, which was, your responsibility to pay whatever it is, 2% or 3% of your GDP, which they weren't doing, if you don't do that, we're going to slap a 30% tariff on you. And guess what? The NATO countries started paying their dues. So my point is, it is a risky strategy, but he uses tariffs as a negotiating tool to get other countries to do what's in America's economic and national security interest. And I applaud that, him for that. One final point. Trump talks about tariffs all the time, but if you compare, there's just a new study that just came out. If you compare tariffs under Trump versus tariffs under Biden, Biden's tariffs have been much higher.
Coming from you, David.
I am concerned about the Trump tariff policy, but in reciting all of his sins economically, I ran out of time in my 15 minutes, so I couldn't get into that. But really, he is totally, completely wrong about where this problem stems from and what tariffs will do. All right. The problem we have with the offshoring of our industrial economy, and it's been massive, and we've lost enormous amount of wealth and output and good jobs, is because the Fed has inflated the hell out of the U.S. economy for the last 30 years, and so our labor costs and our production costs are no longer competitive. So businesses went to China. Businesses went to the supply chain. Businesses took the auto manufacturing process that I was in for a while to Mexico. That was because of the policy errors of the Fed, not because there's some evil foreigners around that are subsidizing their production too much or doing other bad things. And if you want to fix the problem, you go right down to the Eccles building, you look the Fed chairman in the eye and say, enough of this damn money printing, we're going to get back to a sound monetary system and no more of this, because we can't compete in the world if you keep inflating us by 2% a year and say that's a wonderful thing. So that's the first thing about tariff that I would say. The second thing on this question is, I just don't buy the weakness stuff, okay? Russia has a GDP of $2 trillion. NATO, U.S., and Europe has a GDP of $46 trillion. They're not going to be invading Poland. They're not going to be coming through the Brandenburg Gates. They're not going to be occupying the Low Countries and so forth. It's just damn nonsense. And so we don't need to have, a strong defense, a strong policy, a tough guy in the White House in a world where Russia really isn't a threat. Ukraine is just it's a civil war. It's a territorial war in what used to be the Soviet Empire, and it fell apart, and they didn't agree on where the borders were. The whole borders of Ukraine were created by Lenin, Stalin, and Khrushchev, three of the biggest tyrants in world history. Now we're out there trying to defend borders that those bloodthirsty tyrants created. It's nonsense. There's no problem there. Okay. So, anyway.
David has got to stop gesticulating with his microphone.
Okay. Okay.
But otherwise, I hope you all heard him, and certainly you heard Steve. Take it away.
My question is for both of you, and it's something that I haven't heard addressed yet, and that is the potential impact of, say, a Trump appointments, further appointments to the Supreme Court versus Harris potential appointments, and the impact on regulatory policy. I'm thinking of two decisions over the past several years. One was the overturn of the Chevron deference. The second was West Virginia versus EPA, where these will have a major impact on regulatory policy going forward.
Regulatory policies and appointments to the Supreme Court appointments. David, why don't you go first this time?
Well, I think there's a huge issue of regulatory policy. I think some of these court decisions have been very helpful. That's the one great thing that Trump did in terms of his appointments to the Supreme Court. I would buy that. But we can't get carried away when someone starts bragging that they've reduced the Federal Register from 16,000 pages a year to 14,000. You can't count pages. You need to look at the big sweep of things. And when it comes to really bad stuff, all of this green energy crap, all this climate crisis, hoax nonsense, unfortunately, even though Trump did the right thing and got us out of the Paris Agreement, all that stuff stuck around the government agencies and the laws. For instance, you know, this drive to put EVs in every garage was pushed forward by the fuel economy standard that was raised dramatically for the auto fleet. And they're being forced to build cars that nobody wants, or at least at the prices that they charge. Now, Trump addressed this, but instead of leading a charge to repeal that utterly stupid fuel economy law that I dealt with way back in the 1980s, he just deferred the impact and slowed down the increase in miles per gallon for a few years. The minute that Biden got in, they reversed everything he did. What I'm saying is you're not going to deal with this regulatory monster until you change the underlying statutes that give the government the power to do things that's none of his business. I'll finish this one. One of the victories they talked about was that they changed the standard for pressure, shower head pressure, by making sure that it covered that the standard applied to the whole shower head rather than each of eight different pieces that were addressed by the the previous standards. Now, the point is that didn't solve anything because Biden reversed it day one. What the hell is Washington doing setting standard for how much pressure comes out of your shower? So the point is, okay, if you're going to address regulation, you gotta fight it out on Capitol Hill, because that's where all the power, that's where all the discretion, that's where the basic power to use the power of the federal government behind all this stuff actually originates. So hopefully they'll address it this time around, but they can't tinker with regulations. They've got to go full bore to repeal the statutes.
Comment, Steve?
Well said. I agree with everything David just said. I just add a couple of quick points. So think about, we don't even have a Congress anymore. We don't even have a legislative branch. We don't. Why do we need Congress? Virtually all the laws that have been passed over the last 15 years have been done through regulatory agencies and through executive orders of the president. Now, I'm a constitutional guy. I love our Constitution, and our founding fathers were geniuses, the smartest people ever walked on this planet, and they set up a system of checks and balances, and we have an executive branch that carries out the laws, we have a judicial branch which is to interpret the laws, and we have a Congress which is to make the laws. Congress does not make laws anymore. They don't. They don't do anything. They pass a budget. And so here's what happened. Obama moved into the White House in, what was that year? I can't even remember what year that was. He reversed a lot of the executive orders that Bush had put in. And so all of a sudden, in the next 60 days, all of the Bush executive orders were repealed, and now it was the Obama executive orders, dealing with all sorts of things like, car fuel efficiency and on and on and on. And then, of course, Obama, when Trump replaced Obama in the White House, what did Trump do? He had a whole series of executive orders that repealed what Obama had done. Congress didn't do any of that. Trump did it with the pen. And then Biden came in 2020, and what did he do? He repealed all of Trump's executive orders. And, frankly, if Trump wins, and God willing, I think he will, then we're going to have 1,500 executive orders for him to sign on the first day to reverse these things. I don't think that's a very good way to do our government. I think Congress, as I read the Constitution, there's three branches of government, not four. And the regulatory agencies should only get their authority. They should not have lawmaking authority. They should get the authority from Congress. But why? And then the question is, why doesn't Congress do this? Why doesn't Congress pass these laws? Because they don't want to. They don't want to take the heat. So you've got these people, you know, at the FTC and the FCC and the FDA and so on that are making these laws, and they're not accountable to anyone. And I think that's really bad government. So the Chevron decision was one of the most monumentally important Supreme Court decisions of all time. I completely agree with it. Congress has to pass the laws, not regulatory agencies.
Can I just add right here, because Steve and I are in such complete agreement that we might want to note this point. You know, the Congress is supposed to pass laws, but it passed enabling acts, which just delegate open-ended power to the three-letter agencies. Congress is supposed to pass budgets, but it passes continuing resolutions that just keeps the machine going. Congress is supposed to declare wars, but it doesn't declare any wars. It just sends money to the president to, you know, muck around in every godforsaken place on the planet that doesn't affect really the homeland security of America. So I think at bottom, that is the heart, that is the core of the problem that's facing us as we debate these issues.
Next question.
Great. So it seemed like a central problem that both of you discuss is the rising debt over time. And as David pointed out, some policies are kind of working around the edges. And Steve's point was, if you get economic growth, that really can transform the burden of the debt. So my question for Steve is, where exactly would that come from? My understanding is that that comes from changes.
Hey, Steve, you're going to be able to take that question. But let me have David plunge on it first. Go ahead, David.
Where is the growth going to come from? That's interesting.
And I guess my question for David would be, though,
Steve is going to answer it. I know.
Okay.
Steve will answer it. I guess David, just take it, please.
Okay. The question was where the growth is going to come from. And we go back to, we're going back to the 1980s, but it was all about supply side. But over time, what is important for the supply side of the economy? And I believe that completely. Where we're way off base is all this demand side, Keynesian stimulus, Fed, easy money, big deficit. None of that works. You need to stimulate, you need to nurture the supply side. But today, the supply side comes from the labor shortage in this country. And this is going to be very unpopular. But if you look at the data, we haven't hired in the American economy a native-born worker on net for the last 5 years. Why? Because they're not there. They weren't born 20, 30, 40 years ago because native-born mothers didn't want to have babies. So the only way that we can grow our labor force and therefore our economy, which historically has been 50% labor, 50% productivity. That's the equation. Steve will agree to that for GDP growth, economic growth. If we don't have any labor, we have got to have a large-scale guest worker program, not this chaos at the border, but a legitimate guest worker program where people who want to come here, and 95% of these people are economic refugees looking for a better life. They're not political refugees that need to be given asylum and so forth. But if we did that through the embassies and consulates all across the world in Latin America, Mexico, and elsewhere, and vetted people who were, wanted to come to take jobs and kept paying their taxes, we could address the big supply-side problem of the moment, which is we got no labor, and we're not going to get growth without labor growth.
Comment from you, Steve.
So we're just agreeing on too much. That's the problem here. So I completely agree that, one of the biggest issues in the world today that nobody's talking about is the catastrophic reduction in birth rates all over the world. And it's so funny that that's kind of funny and peculiar that we're having that phenomenon going on, because when I was coming of age in the late 60s and 70s, remember the population bomb, and there was going to be 20 billion people on the earth, and we're going to be standing. Do you all remember that? These crazy lunatic ideas. These are the same people who talk about climate change, or the same people who said we're going to face overpopulation. And of course, today the problem is not overpopulation, it's underpopulation.
Why is Trump better than Kamala on that? Is Trump better than Kamala on that issue?
On the issue of immigration.
On the issue of immigration.
Yeah. So David is exactly right.
Birth rates.
What's that?
Go ahead.
Oh, what I was going to say is I'm very frustrated with what Joe Biden has done to our immigration system. It is so contaminated, the immigration system. Americans are just fed up with it. And I'm as pro-immigration as, probably even more pro-immigration than David is. But you cannot have a porous border like we have right now. You just can't do it. And you've got to secure the border. And shame on Kamala Harris for just, and Biden, just anybody can come in. And it has really caused huge problems in communities. And it's reduced, I'm looking at the polls, it's reduced public support for legal immigration. And David is exactly right. We have to secure the border. And then, right now, we let in roughly 1 million legal immigrants a year. Right. I would double that. Immigrants fill vital niches in the workforce, both on the unskilled, all the agriculture work, all the service jobs, not all, but so many of those jobs are being done by hardworking immigrants. They're fantastic for the economy. And then, my God, there would not have been a Silicon Valley. There would not have been the technological revolution that America completely has dominated over the last 30 years if it weren't for the brainiacs that come from all over the world.
And you think Trump is more likely to do that than Biden?
Look, I've talked to him about, we actually had a pretty good immigration plan. People didn't understand. It was basically saying, yeah, let's have I'm not sure about a guest worker program. Maybe we do that. But if people want to come into the country and work, give them a visa. Give them a visa to come. And that would be huge, because David's right. We can't get a higher growth rate or much higher without having more labor. And one last quick point about this. I actually believe that immigration is one of the single greatest comparative advantages the United States have all over the world. Because all these other countries with catastrophically low birth rates, China, Korea, Japan, Europe, they don't have the demographic safety valve that we do. Every smart, hardworking person in the world who wants to leave, they don't want to go to Japan, they don't want to go to China, they don't want to go to Europe, they don't want to go to Germany, they want to come here, and we should exploit that advantage.
We're running out of time for the question, but I want to just ask a question, and then the next person will ask a question, and maybe in the summaries, you'll get an answer. Your question, sir?
Stephen, you said you love the Constitution, which I like. Article 1, Section 8 delineates the powers of Congress, and the 10th Amendment says anything not specifically given to the federal government devolves to the states and the people respectively. Now, as far as I know, maybe you can correct me, I've never seen Trump ever veto the plethora of spending bills. Could you please tell me which one of those spending bills is constitutional?
You can address that in the summary. Next question.
One quick thing about this. I promise it'll take... Yeah, Trump was a big spender. It's one of the things that I did not like about his presidency. There's no doubt about it. He liked to spend money, and it's a big negative on his watch.
Okay, next question, please.
How is supply side not contributing to a recession? Now, the WTO brought China in 2000, and it is a manufacturing-based economy. Their economy is based on manufacturing and not consumer demand. And they are shipping over deflation. They're sending over everything they have to try and keep their economy, because their labor cost is basically zero or very low. They have slave labor, allegedly. So how is additional supply not going to cause a recession? You had the stimulus and the sugar high coming off of it now, and all that inventory was built up, and now it's gone, and backlogs are gone. So how is supply side going to help any?
Next question, please. You might address that in the zone. Next and final question.
It sounds like the answer is yes, but do you think there is a uniparty in Congress?
Uniparty in Congress. Okay, we now have to go. Do you think there's a uniparty in Congress?
That's what it is.
That was his question. Is there a uniparty in Congress? Uniparty in Congress. Yeah, the you don't know what a uniparty.
Not a dime's worth of difference. Is that
right? Yeah. Well, that's in the resolution. The uniparty.
You agree, Steve?
Okay. Now we're under a time constraint with Steve. Steve Moore is going to do his summary, his 5-minute summary, and then he might have to depart. But that will be his last word, and then he can watch tomorrow morning on video what David has to say. Steve. 5 minutes, take it away. Do you want to take the podium? Do you want to do it from the chair?
I'll just sit here. Okay. I've really enjoyed this, by the way, and thank you all for being here and caring enough about your country to listen to our ideas on this. I'm pretty bullish on the American economy. I think where David and I probably disagree the most. He's Dr. Doom, and he may be proven right. But I do think with the right set of policies, if the American people make the right decisions, we can continue to be the world global economic superpower. And I believe this is the single most important issue in the world today. It's the biggest issue in the world today is not climate change or all this other. It's whether the United States will retain our status as the global economic superpower as we have been since the end of World War II. And I would make the case that we are a force for good, not evil. And obviously we have a new rival who wants to supplant us, and that's China. And so I guess to summarize my message tonight, yes, I'm concerned about the debt, and David is right, and he's a hero. You're the Paul Revere for sounding the siren alarm on what we're doing in Washington. But if we get the right tax policy in place, we get the right trade policy in place, I'll kind of end with what Arthur Laffer calls the five pillars of prosperity. And what are those? One is sound money. Sound money. Yeah, David, sounds like you don't think we do have sound money right now. Although we've had pretty good inflation record over the last 30 years or so, except for recently. Second of all, free trade. Free trade. There's no question the freedom to trade is an important thing, and I hope we don't lose that because we benefit from being able to export our high value added goods and import not so high value added goods. The third is what David's talked about, is budget control, a limited government, which we do not have right now. The fourth is less regulation and getting the government off the back of our businesses so they can succeed. And I think there's an American consensus that we should do that. I believe in the free enterprise system. I believe, as that gentleman said earlier, that it is true. The Constitution says that all powers that are explicitly granted to the federal government reside with the states and the people. With the states and the people, and I'd love to get back to that. But I'm optimist. I think, and look, I'm also biased because I am a Trump guy. But I do think if Trump wins, notwithstanding some of the criticisms that David has correctly pointed out about Trump's record, I think it's going to be like taking a champagne bottle and shaking it up. We're going to produce so much oil and gas and coal. We're going to become the number one energy producer in the world. Look, $26 trillion industrial economy. We're not going to provide enough power for a $26 trillion industrial economy with windmills and solar power. It just ain't going to happen. We need to use our oil, our gas, our coal. This country was built on fossil fuels and it will continue to do so. And we can do that in a way with carbon capture and other things like that. So I do remain optimistic, a pro-immigration policy, let's have a low flat rate tax system, 18%, get rid of all the deductions, all the loopholes, all the special interest provisions. Can you imagine if we have an 18% flat rate income tax and the rest of the world's at 30 or 40%? I mean, we would pour so much capital in this country, we wouldn't have enough workers to fill all the jobs. So I'm going to stop there. Thank you, by the way. It's just been a pleasure to be with you tonight.
Steve, if you have to depart, you can stick around. Okay, all right. David, your 5 minutes of a summary. Take it away, David.
Okay. Well, I'm bearish in the short run because I think our political system is failing. back when I was a kid protesting the Vietnam War, the Democrat Party was the Peace Party. It was the party of Fulbright and Church and all the rest of them. Today, the Democrats are the War Party, okay? Today, the Democrat candidate for president is bragging that Dick Cheney endorsed her. Okay? I mean, that tells you everything. Now, unfortunately, the Republican Party that back in the day was the party of fiscal sobriety, small government, and really non-intervention in an aggressive way abroad has been taken over by the neocons, has been taken over by the Washington lobbyists, have been taken over by some of the culture warrior issues and some of the, by really what are kind of nativist immigrant bashers. And they've basically caused the Republican Party to fail to do its job. The Republican Party ought to be forcing the Fed to get on the straight and narrow. The Republican Party ought to be forcing Congress to stand up to the spending issues and balance the budget one way or another as soon as we possibly can. The Republican Party ought to be saying, we're the strongest country in the world. We can spend $75 billion a year on our nuclear triad deterrent, and we'll be safe from anybody else in the world, one. And second, we got the Atlantic and the Pacific Ocean, and nobody's going to come across with 100 aircraft carriers in order to invade New Jersey or the California coast. So let's sober up, get defense back where actually it was in 1960 when Eisenhower gave his famous farewell address. And at the time, and he warned about the military-industrial complex, and all of you know that, but at the time, in today's dollars, the defense budget was $500 billion. It's a trillion today. Why did we need $500 billion up against the Soviet Union, up against the missile gap, they said at the time, up against the threat of nuclear war that we actually came close to in 1962 in the Korean missile, or in the Cuban Missile Crisis? Why was that enough then, by Eisenhower's lights, the greatest general ever to sit in the White House, and yet these characters today in both parties think $1 trillion is not enough to keep us in business everywhere around the world, protecting, for crying out loud, the sandbars in the South China Sea. What the hell are we doing? What the hell are we doing in Taiwan? You know, Taiwan was part of China for 300 years. It only ended up being nationalist China because Chiang Kai-shek lost the war and retreated to the island, and all of a sudden we created, you know, this fake state that was probably there for the Cold War but should have long been gone. So the point is, we need a flushing out of both parties. We need to get the warmongers and the spending and the big government people and the climate crisis or wackadoos out of one of the parties anyway, and organize a new party, whatever happens in the next 4 years, that can change the course dramatically. Now, I happen to think that whoever wins this election is not going to accomplish much because they're saddled with the parties that are part of the uniparty that have gone off in the wrong direction. But I did say in my opening remarks, and I'll close with it, that there is hope that the Reclaim American Party, led by some people who finally, are willing to throw off the shackles of all this nonsense, money printing, wars, spending, debt that we've had for the last 20 or 30 years, that could lead us in a new direction. And that's where I came out in the original debate here, Gene, we're going to have for Bobby Kennedy, Tulsi Gabbard, Elon Musk. Oh, here they are. Their leader is Bobby Kennedy, Tulsi Gabbard, Elon Musk, Tucker Carlson, J.D. Vance, Nicole Shanahan, Vivek Ramaswamy, Rand Paul, Tom, the congressman from Kentucky. There is a core of people who can see that the direction needs to change fundamentally and completely, and I think we might get there by 2028. But it isn't going to happen this time, unfortunately.
Okay, guys, thank you. I have, again, Steve is delaying his departure, and that's nice. I have in my hand the cell phone Tootsie Roll. that goes to the winner of this Oxford-style debate. You have to vote yes, no, or undecided on the resolution, which reads, in the current presidential election, again, Jane, you've opened the voting for the final vote. In the current presidential election, both Democrats and Republicans consist of a uniparty that will lead us to the bottom of the national policy dumpster. You're going to vote yes, no, or undecided. If you voted the first time, we want to hear from you the second time, and then whoever moves the needle wins this Soul Forum Tootsie Roll. I also want to announce that, of course, as many of you know, the Soul Forum has a twofold mission. First, to have the kind of provocative debate we had this evening. Second, to have a party where we can talk about the debate, where we can talk to the debaters. I spoke to David Stockman's wife, and she's going to lead him to that party two blocks uptown, 55 Great Jones. He's got no other choice. You can surround him, and you can pelt him with your questions. You know, obviously, David loves to talk. There'll be plenty of food there as well. Steve is also invited if he wants to delay his departure. Cordially invited, of course. That's at 55 Great Jones Street. Follow me in my wheelchair if you get lost. A lot of other people in the audience who know where it is. It's just two blocks uptown, a huge loft apartment, delicious food, and plenty of convivial conversation. So please do come to that. Jane, interrupt me whenever you get the final vote in. But meanwhile, I want to announce that we have three more debates, an October debate, a November debate, and a December debate. We do a debate every month. Working backward, in December, we're going to have a debate on the merits of presidential immunity. It will be in this hall, and it will be FIU law professor Elizabeth Foley versus Glenn Greenwald on the issue of presidential immunity. That's in December. That's December 11th, Wednesday, December 11th. Working backward, on November 20th, we're going to have a debate on another president, the president of Argentina, a debate about Javier Milei, the free market president, and we're going to have two Argentinians, imagine that, two Argentinians who are experts on the subject debating the merits of Javier Milei. That's Wednesday, November 20th, and again, working backwards, on Monday, October 21st, we're going to have a debate that does read, and this is going to be defended by New York Times columnist David Leonhardt. He's going to defend the resolution, the stagnation of living standards and soaring economic inequality have become defining economic trends of American life. That will be David Leonhardt, New York Times columnist, thesis that he will defend against Cato Institute adjunct scholar John Early. All of those debates are on sale on our website. You can buy tickets for all three. And I see Jane approaching me with the final Tootsie Roll decision. Jane, so let me read. So now the resolution was the uniparty will lead us to the economic dumpster. The yes vote went from 35%.
Hey, we can't hear you.
What?
Can't hear you.
I got carried away like David did. Okay, thank you very much for telling me that you can now hear me. In the current presidential election, the Democrats and Republicans are leading us to the economic dumpster. The yes vote went from 39% to 45.5%, and it picked up 6.5 points. The no vote went from 28% to 40%. It picked up 11.7 points. Therefore, despite the fact that more people voted for David's resolution, the no vote picked up more votes. And therefore, the Tootsie Roll goes to Steve Moore. Steve wants to split the Tootsie Roll. Steve, please come to our party and cut the Tootsie Roll in half at our party and present it to David. David, please come to our party. Two blocks uptown, 55 Great Jones Street. We'll see you all there.